This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world. Today, we're going to start with a 15-minute report on coronavirus, compiled from authoritative sources around the world. There is an awful lot of craziness out there. Let's look at the facts and see exactly where we actually are. I'm not saying it's not dangerous. Believe me, of course it's dangerous. But maybe it is not time to go completely crazy. Maybe it is time to take a close, careful, and responsible look at this virus in our lives. And that's what we're going to do over the first 15 minutes of the show. After that, we're going to be talking to Anthony Peake, who's been on Dreamland off and on for years. He's got an absolutely fascinating new book out called The Hidden Universe. And we're going to be talking about what these non-human intelligences are, the visitors and all of the others, and where they come from in a completely new way. But first, we're going to go over coronavirus with reports from authoritative sources from around the world. This is a dangerous virus. There's no question about that. But how dangerous exactly to each age group? You, your children, your parents? Let's find out, and let's also find out how to protect ourselves and what to expect if we do get sick and what is likely to happen over the next few months. The virus has appeared in Solana County, California, in an individual with no apparent contact with any other coronavirus patient. Because of the fact that the virus is transmissible for an unknown amount of time prior to a patient's experiencing symptoms, it is probable that this virus is not in a contained state anywhere in the world. Now, what does that mean? Health officials insist the risk to Americans remains low. Hundreds of people who were airlifted from China to the U.S. last month were given a clean bill of health and allowed to leave quarantine. Among the people who have been repatriated, about 60 have tested positive. Most of them were from among the cruise ship passengers who were brought back to the U.S. from Japan earlier this month. The vast majority of confirmed cases are considered mild, involving symptoms from a mild cold to a mild pneumonia. But the illness can be catastrophic for about 5% of the patients, particularly the elderly. I'm now going to present the latest information from U.S. and global press briefings, virologists, and research studies. Question: why can't my doctor diagnose it? Answer: the symptoms of coronavirus look a lot like every illness that circulates this time of year, so it's tough for doctors to make a diagnosis solely based on these symptoms. The only way to find out is to be tested. The California Department of Public Health State Laboratory in Richmond is using the CDC's detection test on people repatriated from overseas who are suspected to be infected, but there have been undisclosed problems with it, and that's causing a delay. Tests that are positive must be shipped to Atlanta for confirmation. It's important to be fast, but more important to be accurate. The CDC is fixing its test and soon will send out a new version. When commercial tests are available, there will be greater efficiency. This is a statement from the California Department of Public Health and Dr. Nancy Messonnier, director of the CDC's National Center for Immunization and Respiratory Diseases, and it applies obviously to the whole country. Question: if I'm exposed, how long before I develop symptoms? Answer: the period between exposure and symptoms is 5.2 days on average, but varies greatly among patients. A new analysis still supports a 14-day medical observation period for people exposed to the pathogen. This is from the New England Journal of Medicine. Question: how sick would I get? Answer: across China, about 80% of cases are mild, involving mostly cold-like symptoms to mild pneumonia. 14% of cases have been severe, involving serious pneumonia and shortness of breath. Another 5% of patients developed critical respiratory failure, septic shock, and organ failure. Patients 80 years or older are most at risk, with 14.8% of them dying. Deaths occurred in every age group except in children under the age of 9. For people with mild disease, recovery time is about 2 weeks, while people with severe disease recover within 3 to 6 weeks. This is from the Chinese Center for Disease Control and Prevention. Question, why are some people hit so hard? Answer, experts think it depends on a person's immune response. It seems to trigger an overproduction of immune cells that flood into the lung, causing pneumonia. This is from Angela Rasmussen, a virologist at Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health. Question, how easily does it spread? Answer, each infected person infects an average of 2 to 3.1 other people. That's higher than the seasonal flu, which is about 1.3, but much lower than the measles, which is 12 or higher. This is from Maya Mumjar, Boston Children's Hospital. Question, can I spread it if I'm not sick? Answer, perhaps. In 2 patients, German researchers were able to isolate the virus from the nose and throat even before they showed any symptoms or had very mild symptoms. This from the New England Journal of Medicine. Question, does a mask help or hurt? Answer, the CDC does not recommend wearing masks. Healthcare workers who care for patients with coronavirus should take all precautions. So should household members or close contacts of known or suspected infected persons. But in terms of day-to-day interactions, hand washing is far more effective. A surgical mask is designed to keep the surgeon's germs off the patient, not the other way around. An N95 respirator mask is better in terms of protecting you, but it can be difficult to fit correctly to the face. If a mask is ill-fitting, the virus can find a way in. If you wear that mask, it should be especially fitted. This is from virologist Dr. Warner C. Green, professor of medicine, microbiology, and immunology at UC San Francisco. Question, can local hospitals treat patients? Answer, patients who require hospitalization can be cared for in any community hospital that is reasonably well prepared. Almost all hospitals already have trained for a flu pandemic and should start practicing for coronavirus care now. Dr. Eric Toner of the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. Question, what are my chances of dying? Answer, the death rate, the percentage of known infected people who die, is about 2% in China's Hubei province, where the virus first started, and about 0.7% in other parts of China. The risk of death in those over 80 is high, at 14%. For children and young people, it is very low. That is comparable for the death rate for the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic. It is much higher than the 0.1% fatality rate for the seasonal flu, but it's lower than SARS virus at 9 to 10% and far lower than the MERS outbreak at 36%. Dr. Bruce Alward, World Health Organization. Question, there are no approved drugs to treat coronavirus. Are any being tested? Answer, yes. Trials have already started. The drug remdesivir, made by Gilead Biosciences of Foster City, is being tested on sick Americans at the University of Nebraska's Medical Center in Omaha. While small, this is a rigorous study. It is blinded, with some subjects getting the drug and others getting a placebo. It is also being tested in China. Dr. Anthony Fauci, National Institutes of Allergy and Infectious Disease. Question, there's no vaccine. What's in the pipeline? Answer, it is likely to be a year to 18 months before a vaccine is widely available, but things are moving quickly. The company Moderna Therapeutics already has shipped some doses of an RNA vaccine to the NIH. This could be given to volunteers in a safety test starting as soon as April. Dr. Anthony Fauci. Question, what is happening in China? Answer, astonishingly, the number of new cases is declining thanks to the country's aggressive lockdown. The Chinese epidemic peaked between January the 23rd and February 2nd. 14 other countries have not reported a new case in more than a week, and even more important, 9 countries have not reported a case for more than 2 weeks. Dr. Tedros Ghebreyesus, the World Health Organization. Question, is it a pandemic? Answer, it meets two of three criteria for a pandemic. Illness resulting in death and sustained person-to-person spread. It's moving closer, but has not yet met the third criteria, worldwide spread. Question, where did the virus come from? A new genetic analysis from South China Agricultural University suggests that it jumped from humans to humans from pangolins, long-snouted mammals often used in food and traditional Chinese medicine. If verified, the pangolins may just be an intermediate host. The virus probably originated from bats, but bats hibernate in winter, so it's unlikely that they directly infected people. It is possible that a bat virus and a pangolin virus combined during viral reproduction then infected people. It is also possible that pangolins are just one source of multi-intermediate hosts, and other animals are also to blame. This is sourced from the Xinhua News Agency. How fast does the virus spread? Currently, between 1.4 and 2.5 people on average catch a disease from one contagious person. Transmission is influenced by how much a person coughs and sneezes, and how much virus is in the secretion. If you cough and sneeze a lot, you'll expel more virus and infect more people. Source, Dr. Amesh Ajila, infectious disease specialist at Johns Hopkins. What makes you sick? The virus may trigger a severe immune overreaction called a cytokine storm. A cytokine storm is an overproduction of immune cells and their activating compounds, or cytokines, which triggers a surge of immune cells into the lungs where they cause inflammation. Viruses that have co-evolved with humans over time typically trigger less inflammation. But this virus is new. Source, Jean Caret, Associate Professor of Microbiology and Immunology at Stanford University. Why do people die? The respiratory tract from the nose and tonsil crypts all the way down to the lungs is an excellent port of entry for a virus. The resulting lung inflammation and fluid buildup can lead to breathing distress. It also sets the stage for a secondary bacterial pneumonia. And if the lungs are already damaged from smoking, age, or other infections, then they're much more susceptible to a harmful pathogen. When combined with chronic lung disease, the two problems cause more rapid decline in lung function and are more likely to cause rapid permanent injury. Source, Dr. Jack Coleman, Senior Medical Director of the Lung Health Institute. Why doesn't everyone die? Deaths so far suggest that the new coronavirus has a fatality rate of about 2%. But it's likely an overestimate since mild cases aren't being counted. People who feel minor aches and pains don't go to doctors, so we really don't know the full spectrum of the illness. We need to start detecting mild cases, and so we will learn from that the true burden of the disease. But we also need to understand the risk factors for severe disease so we can focus our efforts on protecting and caring for those patients. This is sourced from Dr. Ahmed Ajila, mentioned above. If you survive, are you immune? People who are infected and then recover will likely show some immunity to the virus, but it's not lifelong. It wanes over time. If it's seasonal, it may ebb and flow. Again, sourced from Dr. Amesh Ajila. What about a vaccine? The first vaccine should be available in about 18 months, possibly as early as a year. Dr. Anthony Fauci, the director of National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, says it will take at least a year. On Tuesday, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services announced that it is partnering with New Jersey-based Janssen Research and Development to share research, development costs, and expertise to accelerate Janssen's investigational vaccine to a level of clinical evaluation. Janssen will also work on the scale-up of production and manufacturing facilities needed to make the vaccine in bulk. Right now, this is what we know, pretty much all of it. I would strongly suggest that you take this calmly, that we listen to professional advice and not panic. You should wash your hands frequently. When you do wash your hands, here's a simple trick. Sing happy birthday to yourself twice while you're doing it. This will give you 20 seconds of hand washing, which is generally considered to be enough to wash off bacteria and viruses. When you're out and about, occasionally use an organic hand sanitizer, or not organic if you prefer. Personally, I use Dr. Bronner's organic hand sanitizer. You need only wear a mask if you yourself are sick, or if you are in the immediate proximity, say, of someone in your household who is sick. Otherwise, it's really pointless to wear masks. The same goes for gloves. You don't need gloves as long as you wash your hands and don't make a practice of touching your face between hand washings or use of a hand sanitizer. You should be fine. Remember always that this coronavirus, is a mild infection in the vast majority of people. It's being yelled about on the news, of course, because it's juicing ratings. But it is not that dangerous a disease thus far. We need to bear that in mind. That may change. And if it does, well, hopefully we'll be able to cope with it. One thing you should definitely not do, please don't do this. Don't open any attachments to any emails about the coronavirus, even if they appear to be sent from friends. This material is literally flooding the internet right now with malware. So the trolls are out in force, of course, as they always are. My guess is that this is going to turn out to be one of the only places where you've heard a lineup of information like this as clearly presented and attributed as it has been here. Please support unknowncountry.com with a subscription. We would appreciate it very much. Now we're going to move on to Anthony Peak. Anthony Peak will be at Contact in the Desert, as will I, May 29th to June the 3rd at the beautiful Renaissance Hotel and Resort in Indian Wells, California. For more information, go to contactinthedesert.com. Anthony Peak is back with us with a book called The Hidden Universe, one of the best books of its kind I have ever read. Anthony is one of the world's most original thinkers in the study of altered states of consciousness. In not just people with drugs, but people like me who live in altered states of consciousness. His work focuses on seeking out scientifically based answers to the great mysteries of human consciousness, from near-death experience to the reality behind ET encounters. We have talked to him many times on Dreamland, the door opening the doors of perception, the out-of-body experience, discussions on time and the meaning of time. Anthony, welcome back to Dreamland.
You know, I've been so much looking forward to this, Whitley. So, you know, it's every time we speak, there seems to be this kind of, as a term I use, egregorial takes place, because your experiences and my attempts to explain these experiences, it's just always wonderful, always wonderful.
Yeah, we're going to have a lot of fun together today, too. But before we start, one of the exciting things that's going to happen is at Contact in the Desert, May 28th through June the 1st, Anthony and I are both going to be talking. I am going to be talking about a new world and how do we take it? How do we live in it and make it happen? Anthony, can you tell us a little bit about what you're going to be talking about?
Right. Well, I'll be talking about the new book, the Hidden Universe, and a lot of the background to that, what stimulated me to write it, and some of the experiential elements of that. And then I'll be also doing a workshop on my cheating the ferryman hypothesis, which is the first time ever in the world where I'll actually be bringing together all the disparate themes in one way. And I'm also hoping that at the event, I'll be joined by a very good friend of mine, a Californian gentleman by the name of Myron Dial, who has, like yourself, has had a lifetime.
We are going to be talking about in just a moment.
Oh, really? That's wonderful, because his experiences are extraordinary. And
interview him on this show.
He would be delighted to do so.
Well, we'll have to arrange that as soon as we hang up. And folks, when you hear what we're going to be talking about in a couple of minutes, you'll understand where I'm coming from here.
Absolutely. And of course, then we have a panel discussion that you and I are both involved in as well, which is going to be really sensational, absolutely sensational. And there's a guy called Andrew Gallimore, who I've seen speak, who lives in Japan. He's an English academic, and some of his theories and ideas very much dovetail into my own. So this is going to be an absolutely incredible, quite incredible hour or two when we're going to be on that stage talking about these things.
Oh, yeah. And there's a lot of incredible people there. Linda Howell will be there, of course. Dr. Kevin Nuth will be there, M.J. Banias, Danny Sheehan, who is always so fascinating, will be there, Clyde Lewis, Stephen Greer is going to be there, I'm going to be there too, of course, Greg Bishop will be there. It's probably the biggest conference of its kind in the world. And so Yvonne Smith will be there, Jimmy Church of Fade to Black will be there, the Coast people will be there. Coast to Coast people will be there. So it's a big gathering. That's for certain. And it should be quite extraordinary. It's at the Renaissance. Let me see. It's at the Gateway Renaissance in Indian Wells, California, May 28 to June 1st. And you go to contactinthedesert.com. That's contactinthedesert.com to look it over and hopefully get tickets, especially to see me and Anthony, because we both want you in our room.
That's the priority. That's the priority.
Exactly. Because in my own second speech, I'm going to be getting into the nitty gritty of how this is in your life, and how can it be in your life, this new way of experiencing reality, because that's what it is. Now I think that it is the right place to start is this with this remarkable man, Myron.
And yes.
Yes. Born in 1944, lived in Inglewood in California, may still live there. When he was 4 years old, he fell into a deep coma. What then happened, Anthony? Now I think that it is the right place to start is this with this remarkable man, Myron.
And, yes.
Yes. Born in 1944, lived in Inglewood in California, may still live there. When he was 4 years old, he fell into a deep coma. What then happened, Anthony?
Well, this is the strangest thing, because while he was in the coma, he had a series of, experiences that he didn't necessarily remember. But when he came to, all his memories were wiped clean, and it was as if he was a different person. And he then started to manifest in his life the most peculiar experiences, where he seemed to exist in two worlds. Now, Myron has subsequently been diagnosed as an experiencer of temporal lobe epilepsy, and it's something he's experienced all his life. He's a Vietnam vet and everything else. But what was taking place in his life was very, very peculiar, because very early on in his life, another entity manifested in him. And an entity he calls Charon. Now, this is extraordinary in many ways, because when Myron first contacted me, it was after my first book, Is There Life After Death? The Extraordinary Science of What Happens When We Die, was published. And Myron was instigated to contact me by his higher self, the being that I call the daemon. We can get into that a little bit later on. But it was his daemon, Charon, that said, you need to contact this gentleman in England. And Myron emailed me and started telling me about his own experiences throughout his life and the way it seems to be that his temporal lobe epilepsy facilitates, as I say, it opens the doors of perception to allow him to perceive the reality behind this reality. I call this reality the kenoma and the reality behind the reality the pleroma. These are terms from Gnostic belief systems.
Why do you choose those two words? In fact, before we go there, I'm going to take the first break so that we can have a nice long time. Free Dreamlanders, we're taking a break. You know what it means, and hopefully you won't be listening free forever. We'll be right back.
Support unknowncountry.com and its great mission to make contact happen. Use our vast archive of interviews, meditations, commentaries, news, and Whitley Strieber audiobooks to expand your mind and your understanding of close encounter. Meet others who have similar interests on our active free message board or in our subscriber comments and Wednesday night chats. There is no other site like Unknown Country in or out of this world. Go to unknowncountry.com and subscribe today. Whitley's new book, A New World, is getting great reviews. American cosmic author Diana Walsh Pasulka says, "Enter this risky new world and leave empowered." New York Times reporter Leslie Keene says, "Riveting. I couldn't put it down." Amazon reviewers are calling it life-changing, mind-opening, the first real description of what contact is like and will be like. Don't miss A New World. As Professor Jeffrey Kripal says in his preface, this book is contact. Get A New World today. Available as a paperback, a hardcover, and an ebook wherever books are sold. And as an audiobook read by Whitley on audible.com.
We're talking to Anthony Peake today. His new book, The Hidden Universe, An Investigation into Non-Human Intelligences. His website, anthonypeake.com. Get the book through us. Click on the link to the book on the Dreamland show page. We're going to be together at Contact in the Desert, May the 28th through June the 1st in Indian Wells, California at the Indian Wells Renaissance Hotel. We'll be with people like American cosmic author Diana Walsh Pasulka, Linda Moulton Howe, Leslie Keene, who broke the Tic Tac story for the New York Times, Paul Hellyer, Stephen Greer, Michael Sala. It's going to be quite an extraordinary conference, so don't miss it. Go to contactinthedesert.com and sign up today. Whitley Strieber, Anthony Peake, all of those others. It is going to be a very powerful experience. Before we... For the Free Dreamlanders, to remind you, subscribers would already know because they had no break. Before we broke, we were just about to start talking about these words that you are using and what they mean and why you've chosen them, Kleroma and Pleroma.
Yeah, it's to do with the ancient philosophical concept known as Gnosticism. And the Gnostics were a schismatic Christian sect in the early years of Christianity. And they created a model of reality based on trying to explain something called theodicy. And theodicy is why it is that a good God allows the existence of evil. Because if God is omnipotent, he could choose to not have evil in the world. Now, what they concluded was that the God of the Old Testament, Yahweh, was in fact what they term the demiurge, somebody called Yaldabaoth. He is a being that thinks he's God, but in fact is not. And he's created this flawed universe. But there is a universe behind, which is the universe of the real God. And that universe exists in a place called the Pleroma. And the Pleroma is actually Greek, and it means fullness. And what has happened is we are trapped within, as I argue, we seem to be trapped within this almost simulation reality, and the place outside Yeah, exactly. You know, we break through, and this is again talking about Myron Dial earlier and other individuals who experience temporal lobe epilepsy and migraine and various other supposedly non-standard psychological states. They see through the kinoma, and the kinoma is the illusion. It's the illusionary reality we live within. And they can break through and see something else and see the multiple levels of reality that sit behind this reality. Now, the problem with this is, and the reason I use these terms is because most of my terms are from Gnostic terms. Like, I argue that our own higher self is called the daemon, which is the entity that guides us throughout our lives. Then there is our everyday self, which exists within the kinoma, which I call the eidolon. And again, these are Gnostic terms. The term eidolon is again from early Christian and ancient Greek beliefs that, you know, we have, it's almost like an on-screen sprite that you have when you play a third-person computer game. It's not the real you, but it's the you that exists for one finite life. But there's a whole series of eidolons, but there's only one daemon. Now, this idea, of course, is very popular now. You know, you for ever since The Matrix came out many years ago, the idea of this reality behind the reality. And of course, as you know, I wrote a biography of the Californian science fiction writer Philip K. Dick a few years ago.
Yes.
And again, Philip K. Dick was fascinated by this. And Whitley, you know from your own experiences that the reality we believe to be tangible is in fact not. And there is a term that's used by consciousness scientists, consciousness study scientists, and they call it naive realism. And that's the idea that the reality that is given to us by our senses is a real reality, because of course it isn't. You know, everything is processed by the brain.
Let me stop here just very quickly, folks, and just explain something. We see everything that we see is generated in our brain. Everything you see, feel, smell, and touch is actually something that your perceptual system gathered and then that your brain interpreted. And that is what you're perceiving, not what's out there. It may be very different out there. And science increasingly is saying this is the case. It is very different out there. But okay, now go ahead.
Because I call this term electromagnetic chauvinism, the idea that I love my little new terms. Electromagnetic chauvinism, I argue, is that we believe that because we see a very small part of the electromagnetic spectrum, we convince ourselves that there is a direct one-to-one relationship between what is out there and how it looks to how our brain processes it. And I came up with an analogy which is American-based about this. And I argue and I suggest that imagine that the electromagnetic spectrum from gamma rays to radio waves is the Mississippi River. And it starts, of course, in a little lake up in Minnesota and ends up in the Gulf of Mexico. Now, what we consider to be the visual world and what we consider to be the reality we see outside is probably 1.5 inches, about 8 miles south of Hannibal, Missouri. Now, clearly, this is very much the world is not as it seems. There was a very famous philosophical paper written a few years ago called "What It Is Like to Be a Bat." You know, bats perceive reality in a very different way. We have people, there are human beings existing now that perceive the world in a very different way because the way in which their brain functions and the way in which they see things, you know, that people can hear, can sort of see music, you know, this kind of thing. Synesthetics, people who suffer from synesthesia. So clearly we need to start to understand that we're being fooled by our brains into believing what is out there is real. But on top of that, as scientists know, and very recent discoveries have proven this, what they've done is they've taken individuals who have been taking psilocybin, which is magic mushrooms, and what they do is they scan their brain to see the brain activity. They do an fMRI scan of the brain, and they are able to tell which bits of the brain are active when somebody's taking these substances. And the fascinating thing is it switches parts of the brain off. It doesn't actually heighten parts of the brain. It switches it off, which is absolute proof if ever it was needed, of the ideas of people like C.D. Broad and Henri Bergson and Aldous Huxley, that the brain is an attenuator. The brain is there to take out information in order that we can function effectively within the conoma. But in fact, the reality and what our senses could tell us is far, far wider and far broader. And when the doors of perception are smashed open or even open ever so slightly, this is when people and individuals like yourself and individuals like Myron Dial suddenly start seeing the reality as it is. Now, we know, don't we, from the myth of Plato's cave, 3,000 years ago, when Plato came up with his idea of the prisoners in a cave, and all they ever see is shadows on the back wall of a cave, and they take that for the reality, take it for reality. One of the prisoners escapes, goes to the cave, out of the cave, and sees reality as it really is, comes back to the prisoners and says, "Hey guys, there's a reality out there. We just don't perceive. We're only perceiving one small part of it." And of course, the prisoners will label him as being insane because they can't perceive what he perceives. But it doesn't mean that his perceptions are no more real. Because the question is, we need to ask ourselves exactly what, when we use the term real, what do we actually mean? We mean it's consensual. It means that we share these perceptions with other people. But that's no more. I know people who go in out-of-body states, and in those out-of-body states, they have shared experiences, which effectively means that if two individuals can share an experience in a dream state, that means it's just as real as this one. They're just levels of reality.
Well, you know, I've had that experience myself. In fact, Linda Howe and I had it. I showed up in Linda Howe's bedroom out in an OBE state many years ago and scared the dickens out of her. I mean, you can't blame her. I mean, she was in Denver, I believe, at the time, and I was in upstate New York, and suddenly there I was peering out of a potted plant in the room.
Wow. And she reported back as well that she physically...
Well, it took her a couple of years to settle down and become my friend again, let me put it that way. But it was pretty shocking to both of us. I mean, I saw a woman, I couldn't tell who it was, and then it was turned out to be her. Now, that went on, though. A few years later, I was going on to a radio show in Chicago, the Roy Leonard Show. And I had an OBE when I was in the hotel, and there was this man and woman in a bed. I was looking down at them. The man, the woman was on her side. The man seemed to be awake. I couldn't tell. And I was wondering, why am I here? And then I went to the show, and I thought, as I was introduced to Roy Leonard, I thought, holy moly, that's the guy that was in the bed. And so he says to me, "What were you doing in my bedroom last night?" And that was awkward. He did a good show, though. It was interesting. And I think he did bring it up on the show, actually. But then more recently, there was a man who's in a lot of trouble. He works in some very classified areas. And when you work in those areas, it's very hard to keep a clean soul. Because the secrets you're keeping, it's toxic to keep them, toxic to you, because they're things that others could benefit from. And talk about denial of the right to thrive. I know you've read The Key, and that's his definition of sin. And keeping things like that secret is the very definition of a great sin. So I was at a conference with this man and a number of other people who were not so awkwardly, I should say, involved in the behind-the-scenes thing. And I found myself unexpectedly. I never leave my body on purpose. I wish I could. I'd be, gosh knows what I'd be up to. But I'm not like Robert Monroe in that sense. But I'm taken out. And in my book, In a New World, there's very specific details about how that happened. So I'm not going to go into it here. But in any case, I'm taken out. And I was taken out. And I was ended up face to face with this man. And I talked to him about the peril of his soul. And afterwards, he became a Catholic. I don't know if he, I mean, I didn't say that, but that was his choice. Essentially the conversation was about, you have to look to the health of your soul. Mm. It's in peril. And that was that. So those are the three times. But I agree with you. And folks, I'm sorry, I'm going to talk a lot during this show. If you don't if you don't like to hear me talking, then just listen to another show when I don't talk so much. Because we're sharing a lot of stuff here. Okay, so let's go on where you were, Anthony, and I'm sorry to have interrupted it like this.
No, not at all. I mean, this is a feedback session. I find I learn as much from you it's just very important. We are all sharing this life experience, and the life experience we are here to learn. And the only way we can learn is by listening, because you have to listen as well as talk. But one of the things that a lot of the times when you were talking there, because I deal with a number of people who experience out of body experiences. And as you know, I've written a book on the out of body experience
yes,
as well.
Yes, I know that.
And I'm particularly intrigued by some of the experiences that I've been told from friends of mine, people I genuinely believe, you know, these are not people that are exaggerating at all. They have definitely been outside of their body. And one particular gentleman called Graham Nichols had a most extraordinary experience. And it was Graham, in fact, in the book, you probably remember in my initial approach to the out-of-body experience, my position was genuinely that it's an hallucination. But the question is, we then have to ask ourselves, what exactly are her hallucinations? Because consensual reality is just as much an hallucination as any hallucination or dream state. Yes. So I wasn't denigrating it. All I was saying was that it's brain-generated like everything else is. So therefore, when you're in an out-of-the-body state, you are in what Celia Green and Charles McCrory call a metachoric state, which is kind of a reality that's created by you, but it's just as real, if that makes sense.
Is it that these people knew could see me?
Exactly. And this is the thing, because then we are then in the position of saying this is then shared perceptions. Now, this yes. is what Graham explained to me. Graham contacted me and said, your book is brilliant, but you're missing a bit here, because people can have shared experiences in consensual reality. And indeed, you can have extraordinary experiences. And Graham staggered me, because he explained to me, and he had witnesses to this. And what happened was he was lecturing to a group of people, and he suddenly felt his legs buckle under him, and he found himself losing consciousness. He then found himself in an out-of-body state, and he's in a jungle. He can feel the heat around him and the plants and everything else and the humidity. Then he walks forward and parts a set of plants and steps out into a corner of Wardour Street and Old Compton Street in Soho in London.
That's
and he's
a
standing.
Big step.
That's a step and a half, isn't
Listen,
it?
Listen, we're going to have to stop here for the Free Dreamlanders. Free Dreamlanders, listen to these announcements and do what we ask you, please.
Unknown Country and Dreamland are unique in every way. The site offers over 16,000 news stories dating back 20 years, all of them with our uniquely open-minded and yet carefully researched point of view. You can find stories of everything from lost cities to multiple witness high strangeness events to the cutting edge of science and reality on the site. For subscribers, the site offers a wealth of material that is mind-opening and can be life-changing. Plus, there are active comment sections, both in the free area and the subscriber area, and a free weekly newsletter. Dreamland, which Whitley Strieber has been hosting for over 20 years, is archived on the site back to 2004. This archive is the only one of its kind in the world, an incredible richness of information that offers exciting adventure every time you dig in. So go to unknowncountry.com daily, get our newsletter, participate in the site's social groups, and above all, subscribe and join this unique community today. Go to unknowncountry.com and click on the subscribe tab to see our options.
We're talking to Anthony Peake today. We're going to be together at Contact in the Desert, May the 28th through June the 1st, along with such people as the New York Times reporter who broke the Tic Tac story, Leslie Keene, Diana Walsh Pasulka, the controversial author of American Cosmic, Deep Prasad, who was with us on Dreamland over the holidays, and will be talking about his extraordinary close encounter in his office last November. Linda Moulton Howe will be there. Paul Hellyer will be there. Stephen Greer will be there. Michael Sala will be there. And so many more. Riz Virk, another great Dreamlander, will be there. It's going to be full of Dreamlanders, actually. Contact in the Desert, Indian Wells, California, May 28th to June the 1st. Don't miss it. Go to contactinthedesert.com and get signed up so you can join us and join the fun. Anthony, you were discussing the experiences of Graham Nichols.
I was indeed, yes. Graham, just to recap, Graham started having an out-of-the-body experience and he found himself in a jungle. And then he found himself standing on the corner of Old Compton Street and Wardour Street in Soho in London. And he described to me that while he was standing there, somebody ran past him and he actually felt the displacement of the air as the person ran past. It was that real. And then he could hear voices calling in the distance. And it was the people in the lecture theatre asking him if he was okay. He then looks down the street to see in absolute horror an explosion take place halfway down the street. A pub blows up and there's people staggering out of the pub covered in blood. He then starts to lose the image and finds himself rising up, and he finds himself coming through in the lecture theatre. When he comes to, the first thing he said, and he has witnesses to this who have signed affidavits of this, he turned around and he said, there's going to be, in a very short period of time, there's going to be a terrorist attack, and he gave the precise location of the terrorist attack, or the attack, the bomb. 5 days later, there was a pub called the Admiral Duncan in Soho, and somebody left a nail bomb in there. And people were killed and many people injured. This is exactly what Graham saw. So here we have Graham not only in an out-of-body scenario, but a precognitive out-of-body scenario where he is seeing something that was yet to happen. Now, this was witnessed, and I know people will turn around and they will say the law of large numbers tells you that if you make a prediction somewhere in the world, it will come true, like a plane will crash or something. This was quite precise. This wasn't, I've seen a plane crash. It was, there will be a bomb in Soho and people will be killed. Now, to me, this was extraordinary. And of course, it made me rethink my own position in terms of external reality and what this reality is. And from here, and I mention this in the book, that there's a group of associates of mine that are doing research at the moment, legal research, into the effects of dimethyltryptamine. And this is taking place at one of the London universities, Imperial College. And people are taking dimethyltryptamine, going into altered states of consciousness, and then reporting back what they see. Now, one of my associate researchers there is a guy called Dr. Carl Smith. And Carl took the intravenously took the DMT, found himself in something called the DMT cage. It's like a glass cage you find yourself in. And he's in this cage, in this other reality, which everybody tells me is more real than this one. It's this reality that becomes the dream reality when people are in these states. And he said, as he was there, an entity came over to the end up the side of the cage and tapped on the cage and may have even physically put his hand on him. And the entity said, you should not be doing this way. Please do not do it this way. And the entity then faded away. Carl comes to, explains this to his associates, and 2 weeks later he's back in the laboratory, takes the DMT, finds himself in exactly the same location, and exactly the same creature comes over to him again and says, I told you last time you shouldn't do it this way. Now, as Carl has said to me, if this is just a figment of my subconscious, it has motivations that are counter to my motivations and seems to have a consistency over time and space, which convinced him that that being, whatever it was real and was independent of him. It was not an hallucination. And this to me is of profound importance, you know, that whatever these entities are that people engage with, Yes, they may be creations of our mind, but they're a creation of our mind that's far more complex than we can believe. They're a creation of using mind stuff in order to manifest themselves within the conoma. And again, in my new book, I do the science of this. I do the neurochemistry and I do the logic of it. And of course, speak to people who've had the experiences of these things. And could this be the explanation of your experiences and many other contactees when they encounter these aliens? I call these creatures egregorials, because the old concept of an egregore is a created thought form. When a group of people get together, they can create something greater than the group. We use the term egregores when my group meets and we discuss things like that. So, I mean, Whitley, you and I now are creating an egregore because the ideas we're talking about now can take on a life greater than ourselves. And of course, we have in years gone by, Alexander Neil, a Belgian-French explorer in the 1930s, created in her trips to Mongolia and Tibet, created something called a tulpa, which is a thought form that can be created by people. And this thought form took on, initially was malleable and she could control it, but after a time it became more malevolent and it became more dangerous. Now, again, this intrigues me because
that made it dangerous?
Well, it just had a mind of its own, and she explains in her book that it started to just look evil. It looked dangerous. Now, this to me, again, is intriguing, and it's something I'm working with a friend of mine, a young Canadian researcher called Samantha Treasure, and we're coming up with this concept that we call the cacodemon, the cacodemon, the idea that there's this kind of sense of evil that can be created. So there's the good daemon, which is our higher self, but there's also elements of ourselves that can be much more evil and can be tangible. And these are maybe the manifestations that people have of incubi and succubi. And, you know, there's no reason why should these entities be friendly to us. They will have their own motivations in exactly the same way. And again, you know, there's a guy called Paul Eno, who you may know, who is an American writer. And Paul actually calls them parasites. And he says they actually feed upon energy. They feed upon our fear. It's our fear that is why they do the things they do, because that feeds them and it's their nutrition. So there's an awful lot of very interesting areas that we can, once we shake off the shackles of being thinking that consensual reality is everything there is, we can start really looking into these and testing them scientifically and doing logical thoughts. And myself and my group, these are the things we're going to be taking forward in the next year. We've got lots of exciting things we're planning to do over here in the UK. And there's more and more top academics getting involved in this as well. So, you know, this is now moving away from the confines of the occultists and everything else. And it's moving now more into science, because science now, we've known in quantum physics since 1926, when Schrodinger came up with Schrodinger's equation, and Max Born came up with his idea that the wave function, in fact, is a statistical wave, that we realize that everything, in fact, is information.
Yes.
Everything we perceive is information. There isn't anything else other than information.
And also, it is something that, as you point out in the book, is in some way expanded, because mostly it's nothing. Mostly, most everything is empty space. Atoms are mostly empty space. If you say here, put it another way, if all the empty space in your body were eliminated, you would be able to fit into a particle of dust, and the entire human species would fit into the volume of a sugar cube.
Now, and that is astounding, isn't it?
You talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, it's the idea, because this is the thing that most people assume, that physical reality out there is not only real, but it's solid. And people point out to me when I lecture, and they'll turn around to me and say, of course the table's solid. It's absurdum ad lapidum. It's the idea of the idea that you kick a stone and you physically feel it, and therefore you disprove the idea that everything out there is just a phenomena of thought. But of course, that's wrong. The only reason your hand hits a table or you don't fall through the chair you're sitting on now is because of electrostatic repulsion. The end of the edges of the atoms and the molecules in your chair and the molecules of your backside and your legs are repulsing each other. So you kind of hover above it. We never actually touch anything physically ever. Now, we then look at the atoms themselves. The atoms are 99.999999999999% empty space. And what is the actual physical things that are inside the atom itself? They themselves are totally ephemeral. For example, the size of the electron, how tiny the electron is, how tiny the nucleus is of the atom. But of course, even the things we see because photons are bouncing off objects around us and stimulating our eyes to turn the electrical stimulus into a chemical symbol, and then it goes to the back of the brain, the darkest part of the brain, and recreates the reality outside. Photons are incredibly weird things. And this is the thing that's so important. Everything you see is photons hitting your eyes. A photon has zero mass. It has no extension in space. It is literally a point particle. However much you focus into it, you will never have a physical object. Now, on top of that, it can only ever travel at the speed of light, which means from its point of view, it's timeless, because we know from Einstein that if an object is traveling at the speed of light, it has to have infinite mass. But of course, photons have zero mass. So the things that we think create the physical reality around us, the atoms, the molecules, the photons, they disappear. We know, for instance, we're drilling deeper and deeper in. We now understand how quarks work together. And everything is either electrons or quarks or photons. You know, these are just the carriers of signals.
Yes.
And it's information.
It's those signals that we're interested in. And I want to go into a slightly different place here and to talk a little bit about shamanism and shamanism as the foundation of all the whole journey into the numinous that mankind has been on for so long. And I thought that instead of you talk about the Aboriginals and you talk about the North American traditions, but you also have a brief passage about the Kogi people and shamanism. Mm-hmm. And I thought that this, as you put it, profoundly shamanistic cosmology was, let's tell us about their cosmology, because I think that's the basis for all cosmologies, including scientific cosmologies.
Totally. The whole model of shamanism is that there are three worlds. There's the upper world, the lower world, and effectively the underworld. And we sit in the middle of these, and shamans can move in the upper world and the middle world and the lower world. And these areas overlap. And what you do is shamans are trained to be able to move within these worlds. Now, the Kogi people are particularly interesting. They exist in the Sierra Nevada de Santa Marta in northern Colombia. And they're part of a very ancient tradition. They go back so far. But what is intriguing is that how they train their shamans, and this is very, very interesting. They actually they will look out and they will spot children that have certain ways of reacting and thinking and everything else as well. Ordinarily, these children will ordinarily be, and they are in most cultures, they are likely to be people who have migraine, or they're likely to be people who experience temporal lobe epilepsy. And it's throughout history. As we know, the temporal lobe epilepsy throughout history has been known as the diviner's disease, because temporal lobe epileptics are known to be able to see the future. Okay.
They thought I had that, and I don't. I was tested extensively for it, but I apparently don't need it. So go ahead.
You don't. Yeah, it's self-evidently, because when I read your books, I thought, you know, it does seem there is elements here of TLE. But having read that you were tested on it, it's because I argue that certain people are naturally open to this anyway. They don't need the facilitation of TLE or any of the other of what I call my Huxleyan spectrum. You don't necessarily need that. Certain people just have it naturally, or it is open for them by other entities who wish to communicate through them. But the Kogi people, what they do is they select the young children. And what they do is, and this is intriguing, for the first 18 years of their life, they keep them in a cave in darkness. And the children are very rarely taken from the isolation of a cave. Now, this is intriguing because I believe I understand why they do this. And it is to do with the pineal gland. And it is to do with training the pineal gland to work in darkness. Now, as you know, the main function, according to neurology, of the pineal gland is to create a substance called melatonin. And melatonin is the neurotransmitter that makes you want to go to sleep. That's why people take melatonin tablets right. when they're flying and everything else. But so there seems to be a direct link between the pineal gland and sleep. And of course, the pineal gland is an ossified eye, and it sits directly above the pathways of light going along the going down to the back of the brain and back to the visual cortex. And because it's light sensitive, it's aware of when it's dark outside. And when it becomes dark, it starts creating melatonin. Now, if you spend all your life or most of your life in darkness, you're creating melatonin all the time. You're creating melatonin to excess. And I believe this is why people have these experiences late at night. This is why people seem to link, and in the book I link this, the amount of times that these entities seem to be related to caves. It's a standard trope from the djinn through to the visions of the Virgin Mary, right through. It always seems to be caves. Now, so the Kogi.
Throughout your book, you talk about caves that are near running water as being caves where this is especially true. And, you know, I thought to myself, the cave I went into to try to contact the visitors when I was living in upstate New York was in a cliff overlooking a stream. There was running water right there. So it was exactly that kind of cave. Now, Free Dreamlanders, when we get back, you're going in that cave and you're going to find some very interesting things. We'll be right back.
Whitley Strieber became the host of Dreamland in 1998, and he's still the host today. One of the first podcasts, Dreamland has been built into the premier program of its kind, exploring the edge of science and reality. The show's archive on unknowncountry.com dates back to 2004. Dreamland is a treasure unique in the world.
At this point in this commercial, I used to say that you can't subscribe because we are still in our old website, but that has changed at last. UnknownCountry.com's new website is available. Go to UnknownCountry.com and take a look. It is beautiful. It offers a huge archive, weekly chats, a free message board, all kinds of great stuff. Whitley Strieber audiobooks for subscribers, and much, much more. New stuff coming on the site all the time. So go to unknowncountry.com, take a look, and really open your mind. How do you do that? By subscribing and exploring and having a great time.
Earthfiles.com is Linda Moulton Howe's great website, offering news of the edge of science and reality. Keep up with Linda's work every single day on earthfiles.com. A new world is coming. Whitley has just finished his book about what it's like to live with and communicate with the visitors. He's been doing this for the past 30 years, and since 2015, the intensity of it has exploded. So be among the first to know what living with them is really like and what it will be like for more and more of us in the future. A new world, unforgettable.
It's now available in paperback on Barnes & Noble and Amazon.com, often at your local retailer. It's available as an ebook essentially everywhere in the world that ebooks are sold. We're talking to Anthony Peak today. His new book, The Hidden Universe, An Investigation into Non-Human Intelligences. His website, anthonypeak.com. Get the book through us. Click on the link to the book on the Dreamland show page. We're going to be together at Contact in the Desert, May the 28th through June the 1st in Indian Wells, California at the Indian Wells Renaissance Hotel. We'll be with people like American cosmic author Diana Walsh-Pasulka, Linda Moulton Howe, Leslie Keene, who broke the Tic Tac story for the New York Times, Paul Hellyer, Stephen Greer, Michael Sala. It's going to be quite an extraordinary conference, so don't miss it. Go to contactinthedesert.com and sign up today. Whitley Strieber, Anthony Peake, all of those others. It is going to be a very powerful experience. We're going to continue now talking about the darkness and what it means in ritual practice and in shamanism and in the deep journey of the soul. So with that introduction, Anthony, just take it from there.
Okay, will do. Okay, before the break, I was talking about the Kogi people and the training they do with their shamans. And the shamans, when they go into these altered states of consciousness, when they're in the caves, the youngsters, they go into a place they know as a luna. And a luna is the alternate reality that I call the Pleroma. Now, the reason I think they're placed in darkness for a long time is, as I was explaining about the pineal gland and the role of the pineal gland and melatonin, there is strong evidence and more evidence developing now. And there's some, funnily enough, I received an article only today from an associate of mine called Beach Barrett, who works with Rick Strassman, has been involved in a lot of the work with Rick Strassman. And it's originally Beach's idea. And it's an incredible, interesting idea that in darkness, the pineal gland synthesizes from melatonin, changes the chemical structure of melatonin, and creates something he melatonin, something he calls metatonin. Metatonin is, in fact, endogenously created dimethyltryptamine, DMT. Now, this is an extraordinary claim to make, I know, but there is growing evidence that DMT, dimethyltryptamine, the most powerful hallucinogenic substance known to man that's in plants and everything else, is a neurotransmitter within the brain. And we have evolved, and we are evolving to work with DMT within our brains. Now, this would explain quite a few anomalies and some puzzles that neurologists have had for many years. For instance, there are things called the trace amine-associated receptors in the brain. There's many of them across the brain in within the neurons. But it's a puzzle because they didn't know what they were for. They were completely puzzled what these TARS things were for. They've now found that the TARS react to dimethyltryptamine. They are designed to work with dimethyltryptamine. This in itself is interesting, but what is more interesting is that in, I think it was 2015 or 2016, there was a researcher called Jimo Borjigin at the University of Michigan. She's a Japanese-American researcher. And she discovered, and this is one of the things that if you talk to people out there, they'll say that DMT has never been found in the brain. Breaking news, it has. Not only that, it's been found in the pineal gland of mammals. Because what they found was they actually tested the pineal glands of live rats, and they found DMT in them. Now, the reason they use rats is because neurologically, the rat's brain works very, very similar to the human brain in terms of how it works. So, for the first time, they found active DMT inside a pineal gland. The question is, how did it get there? And that's the billion-dollar question. Was it being created by the pineal gland, or was it somehow in the brain anyway? Because DMT is found in the stomach, it's found in the liver, it's found in the spinocerebral fluid, and it can cross the blood-brain barrier. And the major problem is with DMT is it rapidly changes into something else. When it's in the brain, it will change. But they found it. Now, this is intriguing because this could explain why the TARS receptors exist. And it could be evidence that what Rick Strassman, the author of the famous book DMT, the Spirit Molecule, has long argued that DMT is our reality modulator. It is what helps us create reality. Now, then we have some very interesting areas because we know just how extreme the experiences that DMT can create. But I'm now working with and for many years now, I've been associated with two Austrian researchers called Dirk Prokol and Dr. Engelbert Winkler. Now, I am hoping that Dirk and Engelbert will be with us for the Contact in the Desert event. I'm chatting to them about it, but we will have with us because there will be at least three people traveling from various parts of the United States who are US agents for the machine that they have invented, which is called the Hypnagogic Light Device or the Lucia number 3. And we're going to have some of those machines with us. And well, I'm hoping
fascinating.
This machine is unbelievable. And I believe, and I've used it many times.
What does it do?
I think it actually stimulates, it uses white light and stroboscopic light to create what's called cliverform constants in the brain. It's like kaleidoscopic imagery. It's very similar. Brian Geisen and Edgar and Burroughs did a lot of work on this in the 1960s. But the difference is that for the first time, two professionals, one's a consultant neurologist and the other one is a consultant psychologist, and the two of them will work together to build this machine from the bottom up because they know what they wanted it to do. And I believe what it does is when you're in, you go into an altered state of consciousness very quickly. Most 99% of people have an experience with this machine. I know of nobody that has not had an experience with this machine, these machines. But I believe what takes place is it stimulates the pineal gland to start synthesizing endogenous DMT.
You know, and when it does, I'd be very interested in trying that because this, of course, is. That's what they believe my brain does. My brain, I have to say, has been studied fairly extensively at this point because right. it's an extremely unusual brain. And I can do things that, well, like contacting the desert's a perfect example. Last year at Contact in the Desert, I disappeared completely before the eyes of a number of people.
Really?
And then reappeared. After sitting down in a lecture, Jacques Vallée's lecture, in fact. And, you know, that's, that is, there's really powerful stuff going on there. And
What did you recall, Whitley? What did you recall happened to you? Do you remember,
it felt like the air pressure changed, but nothing, I didn't feel like I was in another world. I felt like there was a sudden drop in air pressure. And I said to the person walking along beside me, what's that? What's happening? And he just didn't say anything. And I thought, well, he's ignoring me. He was ignoring me because he didn't hear me because I was not there anymore.
Wow.
This is what
Jenny Randalls, the British UFO researcher, calls the Oz factor. You know, and it seems to be a kind of curious state where there's a kind of an electricity in the air. There's a kind of Graham Nichols tells me, he calls it the cerulean effect because everything seems to be tinged slightly towards the blue. And out of body experiences, I know, tell me about this as well. So it's again joining the dots, isn't it? You know, we have experiences like yourself, and all we need to do, I always feel that the evidence is there. We have this huge jigsaw puzzle. And we just need to put the pieces together.
Try that machine when I'm there and see what happens.
Oh, Whitley, we will have to film you doing it because that would be absolutely incredible. Because with your unique experiences and clearly with how your brain works, what a Lucia would do to somebody like you beggars belief.
I wonder, because I was advised a long time ago, don't touch drugs of any kind. No hallucinogens, no marijuana, nothing. And I've been faithful to that always. But I think that inducing an increase in its production naturally within my body probably would be very interesting.
Totally, because this is the whole argument that I've used in my presentations. And I've said, suddenly, if this hypothesis is correct, we're in the circumstances that effectively every human being is literally a drug carrier and is carrying something totally illegal inside their brains.
In other words, we are hardwired to have numinous experience and perceive this larger reality.
Totally. And that's exactly my argument in my book, Opening the Doors of Perception. This is exactly what I argue, that this is an evolutionary thing. We have evolved to do this. And it's very intriguing because there is counter arguments to say that with something called the cosmic anthropic principle, which argues that the universe since the first millisecond of the Big Bang has been hard programmed to create consciousness, and consciousness itself brings about the universe around us by the act of observation. And we know this from quantum physics, you know, the collapse of the wave function.
Right.
Which we haven't got.
After she died, my wife is still in touch with me, and she's extremely wise. And people are, after they are out of the physical world, or many people are, and she's one of them. And she said something so interesting and that's germane to what you just said. She described the origin of the universe as a yearning that underlies gravity. And gravity, of course, brings the physical world into being.
Mm.
A yearning. Isn't that an extraordinary word to use?
It is a wonderful word to use, because one of the things that has been long argued is that the universe itself is using consciousness to become self-aware. You know, that consciousness is the ground state of everything. But in some way, the consciousness of the universe, and definitely the consciousness of individual human beings, we suffer from what the ancient Greeks called anamnesis. We suffer from amnesis, which is forgetfulness. And we need to be in a state of anamnesis, which is what the pre-Socratics used to talk about. It's the ideas of Plato, the idea that we are a singular consciousness experiencing itself subjectively, that the universe itself, God, is the collective consciousness of everything, and we are emanations from that consciousness, and that we are moving towards becoming self-aware within the simulation. And suddenly we get these wheels within wheels. It's like holograms work. As you know, if you smash a holographic image up, you don't end up with like pieces of a jigsaw puzzle with parts of the image. You get denuded full images. So the whole is created, is part of the whole is part of the greater something. And again, this is something that the great American quantum physicist David Bohm was writing about in the 60s and the 70s when he was at Birkbeck College over here in London. And he was arguing what he calls the explicate and implicate orders, and the idea that everything is enfolded within itself. And of course, your other great American researcher, who's sadly no longer with us, Bohm is no longer with us, and also Carl Pribram. And Carl Pribram was arguing that the brain works on holographic principles, as does the universe. So we have a hologram processing a hologram, and it's all information, or in, as Bohm called it, information. And everything, you know, is information.
There was I knew Carl Pribram vaguely. I had a few conversations with him at the World Affairs Conference in Colorado years ago. I wish I had known him better. There's also a book, The Holographic Universe.
Michael Talbot,
who was a dear friend, and I think that his approach to it is very vivid, let me put it that way, because you begin to understand what that actually means. It's easy to say, holographic universe, oh my. But when you think that that means that all are one and one is all.
What's important here, Whitley, is to understand that Talbot was a wonderful guy, and he a huge influence on me. I wish I'd met him. I have to say, it's one of the sad things, he died so young. But the work that's now being done across the world, looking for the digitization of space and space-time, and most people are blissfully unaware of this. There's a guy called Craig Hogan at the Perimeter Institute in Ontario in Canada. They're doing some amazing work trying to find the pixelation of space. There's a guy called Juan Maldacana who's been working on this. I think he might be Brazilian. Then there's the late Jacob Bekenstein, who was an Israeli physicist. These guys have already joined the dots. We already know that it's a hologram. They even know how the hologram works. It's to do with black holes. It's to do with something called Hawking radiation. The very last paper that Stephen Hawking wrote before he died was revolutionary. And he was suggesting that everything is information. And the mystery is, and it comes down to, if you throw, I don't know, a computer, a laptop or something into a black hole, information is lost. Data is lost in an enclosed system, and that's impossible. And they believe that all the information that the universe contains is actually smeared on the outer edge of the universe in tiny little Planck square length Planck squares. And each one of these Planck squares contains one bit of information. Now, the extraordinary maths of this, I wrote a book with Irvin Laszlo about this a few years ago. And if anybody needs to read this stuff, my stuff is good. And Irvin Laszlo really, really is one of the main men in this area.
And subscribers, you can listen to interviews with Irvin Laszlo in the subscriber section in the archive, of course.
Excellent. And of course, Irvin, they did the calculation and they said, if you calculated the size of the inside of the sphere of the universe, because, you know, the universe is spherical. So therefore, from the Big Bang, everything is moving outwards. And it's been going outwards for, what, 13.5, 13.6 billion years. But it's finite. And it's like the inside of a balloon. And we're in the middle of the inside of a balloon. Now, if you had Planck length squares all dotted all the way around that inner surface of the balloon, and then you calculate the amount of data needed to process physical reality as it is, the figures match. They actually match, which is extraordinary.
Yes.
But I'd like to make one final point about evidence that this is a simulation. And it is the most extraordinary thing, and people see it regularly and don't ever think how weird it is. And it is simply this. You watch a total eclipse of the sun. What are the chances that the sun is exactly 800 times the size, 800 times or something, it's to do with 800 times the distance. The sun is 800 times further away than the moon is. When the moon occludes the sun for a total eclipse, it absolutely accurately, absolutely covers the sun's disk. Now, think about that for a second. All the other satellites in the solar system are much smaller in relation to their home planet. The moon isn't, and it matches. And I always think to myself, statistically, that's impossible.
Yeah,
and I always think that is a little clue.
The solar system is statistically impossible. There's more to it than that, even. We are exactly the right distance from the sun to be just in the dead middle of its the area where it can sustain life. The outer planets, especially Jupiter, are there in such a way that they sweep up most of the cometary material that would otherwise have turned this into rubble long ago. And our second line of defense there is the moon itself, which, if you look at it, is covered with craters for a reason. It captures much of that as well. And what you're saying here, you add all of this together, and it's not possible.
This is very much Whitley the cosmic anthropic principle. This is exactly what they argue. And they argue that the chances of life evolving as it is so infinitesimally small. And even from the first few moments, the balance of matter and antimatter was crucial. You know, there are the whole series of these amazing coincidences that took place to ensure that conscious life evolved. Now, I know people will turn around and say, well, don't be silly. You know, I know that Douglas Adams, for instance, the guy that wrote Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, made this joke about it. And he said, there's a puddle of water. And the puddle of water thinks to itself, isn't it amazing that this hole I exist within is exactly the right size for my body? And he then gets evaporated because the sun comes out. But that's fallacious. And it's fallacious for one reason. If we believe that this universe has only existed once, and this is only the one universe there is, it got everything right first time. Now, the only other alternative is Hugh Everett III's 1957 PhD thesis on the many worlds interpretation. Because, of course, he argued in his solution for the Schrödinger's cat mystery and the collapse of the wave function that this is one of trillions of universes. And the universe splits into copies of itself billions of times a second to accommodate every outcome of every decision. Now, again, towards the end of his life, Stephen Hawking himself wrote a paper with Frank Hartle of CERN, and they came up with something called the top-down hypothesis. And the top-down hypothesis actually suggests that every outcome of every decision exists out there and is collapsed by you making decisions. And that's the only alternative we have. There's either been one universe and it's got it right first time, in which case the cosmic anthropic principle applies, in which case it's designed in some way. Or there's a multiverse and there's billions of universes, which means there's billions of Whitley Strieber and Anthony Peaks having this conversation now. And you, Whitley Strieber, will have had the opportunity over myriad of lives to actually fulfill every alternative reality of your life. It's fascinating, but they're the only two options available.
We have come to the end of our free Dreamland. In the next part of Dreamland, we're going to begin to talk about experience and beings. And the fact is that a lot of these of listeners have had many contacts with entities. And what are these entities? And above all, why has it changed so much starting in the middle of the 20th century? So we've got quite a journey to go on still. And Free Dreamlanders, I'm going to tell you goodbye, but I'm also going to say to you, you're missing something very cool, because the next half hour of this show is going to be absolute dynamite.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by UnknownCountry.com and its family of subscribers. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Strieber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Strieber is your Dreamland host, and I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander. Thank you for listening.